So welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 8. Before we begin, of course, we cannot forget that we live and work in Srepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepek people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now today, listeners are going to meet two families who have recently established themselves in the Shuswap and are making already a name for themselves as growers, producers, wholesalers, and retailers of fresh, healthy, local meat and eggs in the Shuswap. And who better to talk about what happens in a family than the mother from each family? We are joined today by Lydia McKnight, co-owner of Yankee Flat Meats, and Chelsea Keenan, co-owner of Keenan Family Farms and the Black Forest Noodle Company. They're going to talk with us about how their businesses are an expression of their passion for food security and ethical farming. So welcome, Chelsea and Lydia, to Food Conversations.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have you here today on this cool autumn morning. Now, I realized looking at the website that the Yankee Flats Meats website, that it's only 6 months old. Really, yeah. I mean, in terms of its formal existence. So I wanted to congratulate you for having really come on to a flying start after what clearly, and as listeners will hear, was a bit fraught beginning. This is the way the food industry and the food world is working these days. Now, I went to your website, Chelsea, Keenan Family Farms website. And there's a quote here that I wanted to share with you because I think it really does exemplify what both of your families are trying to do and some of the principles that animate what you're doing. And this is what it said. We want to demonstrate a strong work ethic to our children. We want them to be connected to where their food comes from. We hope that they never take food for granted, and that they learn the importance of respecting and caring for the animals that nourish us. Our goal is to raise food for our family and our community while sustaining our environment for the future. Knowing where your food comes from starts by knowing your farmer and educating yourself on their practices. So, Chelsea and Ilya, starting with you, Chelsea, when you hear me reading this back to you, what does it conjure up in your mind as you're reflecting on the work you do?
I think that quote was written right at the beginning, right at the start when we moved up here from the Lower Mainland. And I haven't actually heard it read back to me in a while. And it actually, I'm proud of that. I think that we have achieved some of that. So I like that. So thank you for reminding me of that.
Thanks for telling me who I am. Lydia,
yeah.
it seems to me it works pretty well for you guys too.
Yeah, hearing that quote and seeing Chelsea's life and working really closely with Chelsea, I almost get emotional thinking about it because I see that in her life and mine as well, and that's something that we are trying to achieve as well. So definitely emotions coming up with that.
Well, I actually had some strong feelings about it myself because it exemplifies what I think are trends that are happening these days and are becoming more prominent as well, and are a change of sort of philosophy from the way things have been for a long time, the kind of let's make money and get big. And for both of you, it's clear that there are very important values different from those that are animating what you're doing. So let's start with you, Lydia. You and Scott, your husband, about 3 years ago, were running a business called Beast and Block, which isn't as captivating a name as one you have now, but I mean, I can understand why you had it. It was a retrofitted shipping container used for meat processing. And what was interesting, you said that Scott had taught himself meat cutting and processing, which is an interesting 21st century twist to things, that you can learn a ton of really precise information. What, from the internet? Is that what he did?
Yeah, so he had always grown up hunting and was always interested in fishing and hunting. And whenever he hunted, he would process his own animals and he would just learn from books and online. And then when we got to raising pigs for ourselves, we did two pigs for ourselves before we got into anything. He did the on-farm slaughter because it was just feeding our family, and then did the processing himself. And he did a lot of research and had the practice that way online and through reading textbooks.
And you were your operation at that point was fully licensed. It was sort of covered by all the formalities. And you sent your, at that time, you didn't have a facility yourself, so you sent your pigs to an abattoir. Was that Roca Meats that you were sending it to?
Yeah, so what I just spoke about was when we did two pigs for ourselves the year before, and then once we had Beeston Block, we had our facility licensed by Interior Health. So that was all fully licensed when we started selling meat to the public, and then we did have to go to Rocanna Meats to get our animal slaughter because the farm gate abattoir wasn't available. That license wasn't available at that time, which it is now. So you can get that license. It's very limited though. So you would have to be a small scale producer and slaughter yourself once you get that license, but that would only be for farm gate sales, or for like kind of family consumption, that sort of thing.
And then an interesting thing happened. Your parents-in-law were selling, and this was putting a little bit of a wrench in the works. And then one day there was a cold call from Chelsea. And Chelsea, take it over. What was happening? You'd moved up from the coast, from the U.S., in a condo down there, and had bought 35 acres in 2017, and you were raising pigs and laying hens. And you're doing okay. And after 2 years, you were shipping down to the coast at this point. And then you got into a crisis because this abattoir was closing that you had booked for an entire year. You'd booked all your dates for slaughtering at this abattoir. So you made that cold call. And what were you calling about?
That's right. So we were informed by the abattoir that we were using just north of Kamloops that they were no longer going to be processing pigs. And that was January of 2021. Is that right? Yeah, January of 2021. And so they let us know that all of the pigs we had booked for the entire year no longer had processing. So I frantically look through the list of people I knew that could butcher for us, or people that I didn't know, people that I could reach out to.
And anybody,
My first call was to Scott McKnight at Beeston Block. And initially he said he wasn't able to help us because he didn't have a space. His shipping container was homeless almost at that point.
So was this at this point where you had your famous sitting down and having a cup of coffee meeting, or were you still on the phone?
I was still on the phone. Yeah. So I was
panicking,
cold calling. Yeah. Trying to get butcher dates for all these pigs. So at that point we would have to use Rocanna Meats and Salmon Arm for the actual slaughter, but we still needed a butcher to do the cut and wrap. So that phone call to Scott actually did progress to a coffee and to an invitation to move their shipping container to our property.
Okay. I have a vision of the four of you sitting down and going back and forth. What was the atmosphere at that meeting? I mean, both of you were in a degree of distress because of what was happening, but also looking for solutions. So what was that like to meet and get to know each other?
I think
you could speak on that, Linda.
Yeah, I was going to say it probably makes more sense because I was coming into your home. But from the very beginning with all of this, I think both of our families deal with problems very gracefully. We kind of expect, like once you run your own business, you kind of expect to come across problems, and we've dealt with so much that it's just the way it is. So we went into it saying, well, we're going to meet a really cool family that farms. We looked at their website when we were creating our business, and we're using them as inspiration for what we want to do.
Already.
So I was like, well, I kind of already know a little bit about their family. I feel comfortable going there. We walked in and it was just a really warm, calm environment. We were talking and had a lot in common. We had mutual friends, and yeah, it was honestly, I don't even think it was like 30 minutes into the conversation when Chelsea's like, well, you could just move here and we can raise the pigs, you do the processing, we'll do marketing, and then we'll just have that system that just works for both of us. And we were like, okay, she's very gracious for saying this. let's go think about that and come back. But it seemed like an answer to our prayers, honestly. So we were really excited, and it just felt right.
And one part of this exciting new development, the horizon of solutions looming up in front of you, was Chelsea, that you applied for and earned or won the BC Egg New Entrant Program access. It sort of came in the middle of all this. Describe that what kind of a change that brought into your lives.
So we had what's called a small lot permit with BC Egg, so we could have 399 laying hens. This new entrant program with BC Egg allows you to have 3,000 laying hens. And then you're also, this program, you're doing all self-marketing. So you are washing, grading, distributing, marketing all of your own eggs. Mm-hmm. And this is something we had been doing already for 3 years on a smaller scale. But it's something we felt comfortable that we could accomplish with ease because we had the market, we had the name out there, we had the brand. Right. And so consequently, when Scott and Lydia came over for coffee that day, Scott was also in construction, has a construction background, mm-hmm. as does my husband, James. And so when we had found out that we had won this lottery, they call it sometimes, we needed to build a barn. And so the relationship really was multifaceted because we all agreed that the beets and block container was going to come to the Keenan property. And when we weren't processing pigs and doing butcher work, Scott and James would start building a barn. And so that happened all at the same time as well.
I'm just going to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Lydia McKnight, who's the co-owner of Yankee Flats Meats, and Chelsea Keenan, who is also co-owner of that, as well as Keenan Family Farms and the Black Forest Noodle Company. So both of you have children, but this was the biggest child you'd ever born, and that was the Yankee Flats Meats suddenly appeared on the horizon. And you sought specifically a Farm Gate Plus license. Now, why don't you let listeners know what that is? Chelsea, is that, or which one of you? Yeah, go for it, Chelsea.
Okay, so then fast forward, it was only, 6 months? Wasn't long until we got the phone call that Rokana Meats has shut down. And that's where we were getting all of the pigs slaughtered with provincial inspection. And then the pigs would come back here for the cut and wrap. So when I can remember the day, it was in August, and Scott and James were on the roof strapping trusses down. And I came over and I said, you wouldn't believe the phone call I just got. And we all looked at each other and said, I guess we're going to build a slaughter plant. That was the day that Yankee Flats Meats was born. And so, I mean, it couldn't have gone any better, really. Like in the face
things were
of
just falling
adversity.
Into place. Things were falling
yes.
into place. Just
in the face
universe
of adversity,
was,
we just yeah. took it on. Yeah. So we applied. In the meantime, before we could build our slaughter plant, we had to apply for a Farm Gate Plus license, which is where we're allowed to slaughter a limited amount of animals on our property. But that was really just a bridge for us to get to build the abattoir and get fully licensed.
Now, we talked about interior health a little bit, and Lydia, you're employed as a dietitian with interior health. So you're familiar with the rules and these sort of, I can tell you, the healthcare system, and for listeners, there's a lot of rules. And so the licensing process, you know, the whole idea of having to get licensed, you'd already got some licenses for yourselves before. How does that work? I mean, you phone up somebody, said we'd like to get a license, or you go online, get a form and start filling it out, and then negotiations, discussions with staff in interior health, they come out and do so. Just describe the process a little bit.
Yeah, so my husband Scott was the main person looking into those regulations and everything. But honestly, I would say the majority of people that we worked with from Interior Health were actually really helpful. I know when we started Beast and Block, we had approached them when we were designing things to make sure everything was exactly how they wanted it before we built it, rather than building it and then them come in and be like, oh,
Oh,
your
for
floor is
sure.
going to be on a slant and everything like that.
Yeah.
So I think there was a lot of collaboration with the regulations. Now, there are a lot of regulations, and for abattoirs specifically too, there's a lot that we needed to abide by, and some rules made more sense than others, but we abided by them.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a lot to go through to get a provincially licensed abattoir. It was not easy. It was privately funded, and yeah, that it's a lot of work, and there's a reason why not everyone starts an abattoir.
Yes, indeed. And also housing for chickens. There was that was part of the process as well, a large scale. Chelsea, that was your part of your agenda.
Well, and so then what happened was all of the team from Beast and Block and Yankee Flats Meats doubled up as construction workers. So the same lovely, kind gentleman that built the barn and built the abattoir then rolled over and became meat cutters. And so that's a really cool investment of their time to work in a building that they actually physically built, which I think adds to the culture here for sure.
The interesting thing about this is that, and there were some comments that were made, I don't know if it was when we were speaking or it was on one of the websites, about how the food system can be fragile. And I'm just imagining that at this point, when all this change was taking place and you were trying to make sure that next steps would follow and you could do what you wanted to do and you could get the licensing you wanted to get, it must have seemed kind of the fragility of the food system was very much part of your lives at that point on a regular basis. Lydia, what do you think about that?
Yeah,
Were you scratching your
for sure.
head?
I would see that in whenever we had a small natural disaster or small closure in highways, how there would be a panic and grocery stores would be empty and there would be online forums asking where they could get meat, and then we would sell out of our current stock. So the fact that our food system is that fragile that we couldn't even have a week of closure of highways and we weren't able to sustain that locally is scary to think about what would happen if something larger occurred.
Indeed, I remember talking to people at Memorial University in Newfoundland, and all the food in Newfoundland practically is imported from off the island. And they have enough for 3 days. And if there's a big storm or there's some kind of, meteorological catastrophe, they're in really big trouble. And if there ever was an argument for having locally produced food, which can be done in that part of the world, even it's a little different climate, but as here, it really would make a lot of sense. Now, just so listeners can be reassured, the project has moved ahead since March. Things are going well. And now you're handling animals who come from about 10 or so other farms, mostly in the area. Why don't you just list the kinds of farms that you have and how many pigs they bring to you? What's that like, Lydia?
So we have about 10 different farmers. 95% are within the region of Thompson, Okanagan, Shuswap. One is just outside of that area. So all within about an hour drives. We have chicken farmers down the road from us that raise, and they raise for us. And then we have a handful of lamb farmers in the area that are like just down the road on Salmon River Road or in Lumbee. And everyone brings a different number, and it's kind of depending on the demand. Chelsea, you said that what's your capacity at right now? I'm trying to think of how many we do for you. So Chelsea's our pork farmer.
Chelsea, you can
Yeah,
answer
so
that
I think,
question.
yeah, I think we're producing about 10, we're producing 10 a month maybe right now.
Yeah, and
We
lamb,
just,
so I'm not sure.
yeah. And I was going to say the pigs are here on the same property as the abattoir. So we kind of just load them off the field.
And that's why I don't know exactly. We just take them as
yeah.
we need
them. Yeah. This is a working operation, not a keep deep data. Well, I think it's important for now for listeners to have an idea of what you actually do, because what you do is very different from the way most pigs are grown all around the world. And I did venture into exploring a little bit about factory farming for pigs. So I thought I'd ask listeners to put their hands over their ears while I describe some of the things that happen in conventional raising. This is a quote again from the internet. It's about what happens to little pigs. Piglets often have the following performed: castration, earmarking, tattooing for litter identification, tail docking, teeth clipping to prevent cannibalism, instability, and aggression, and tail biting that is induced by the cramped environment. Because anesthetic is not legally mandated and often economically unviable, these invasive procedures are usually done without any painkillers. While wild piglets, and your piglets, I might add, remain with their mothers for around 12 to 14 weeks, farmed piglets are weaned and removed from their mothers at between 2 and 5 weeks old. The pigs begin life in a farrowing or gestation crate, a small pen with a central cage designed to allow the piglets to feed from her mother, the sow, while preventing her from moving around, crushing her children, and reducing aggression. The crates are so small that the adult pigs cannot turn around. Now, I'm sure there's been some imagery on the internet, if people have looked for it, that illustrates what's going on. And there's other aspects that are not to do with direct animal husbandry, but things like waste lagoons, giant ponds full of animal feces and urine that are incredibly toxic and produce all sorts of trauma to the soil and to the ecosystem. Now, there could be no more stark contrast with that than the way you are raising your animals. And I think we should talk about that a little bit. You make a point of not using hormones to enhance growth, not using antibiotics for growth enhancement as well. And that's applying to both your chickens and your pigs. You don't use corn or soy. And the animals have access to the outdoors. So why don't you describe a day in the life, Chelsea, of the pigs on your property? How do they live?
Well, if they're not ripping around my lawn.
Your lawn you've given up on.
Yeah, that's right, in the garden. They live outside year round. They farrow mostly. We do try and separate the sows just for farrowing, so that, because what happens is you'll get bigger pigs that come in and try and nurse off of a farrowing sow. They try and steal the colostrum.
Yes.
We call those little bandits. So a sow does hopefully get a private space, but she is in no way confined with some dry hay. And but then the piglets will stay with her for an indefinite amount of time.
As long as they want.
Yeah. So they're outside. We don't have an inside space for the pigs. We have an open air barn with some stalls in it.
Sort of a shelter.
Yeah, that's right. But they've got their hay, they've got their space to roam, and they mostly just laze around. In the summer, they love to lay in the water. We've got a big wallows for them.
Yes, I saw the wallow. It works well. They come out muddy.
Oh yes, yeah. So there's no stress in these pigs' lives. You can get in there with those pigs and give them belly rubs, and it's a very, very stark contrast. Absolutely.
And your kids are active out in the fields with the pigs.
Yeah, well, they're not afraid.
No. One thing you said when we were talking before the show, you said, and we're going to talk about how pigs are slaughtered, because I think that's another thing that's radically different in the way you do it from the way it happens in this factory setting. You said, these are your exact words. You said, we honor their death and take care of them in their life. I'd like you both to just tell me what goes through your mind when I repeat those words back to you, because to me, they they had a real emotional content. Lydia, what are your thoughts about that?
I think there's a few things that make us a bit different in terms of our slaughterhouse abattoir. I'm really proud of the way that the animals are handled and cared for up until the very end. Our staff are really good people. No one likes a slaughter day. They do it because it's a need in the community and they know they're feeding the community. They right. don't do it because they like to kill animals.
For sure.
That is not the case. Each one is cared for. They're in an open barn area up until the very end. It's a really relaxing environment. There's no loud noises, no big stresses. A lot of them lay down, which shows that they're relaxed. They're in their pens laying down. And each one's taken one by one. It's not like this mass situation. And it is done on a smaller scale. And our staff care for each one individually. And I do agree with that statement. As I walk through with my son, who loves animals, who's one, we go on slaughter days sometimes, and we see the animals in the pens waiting, and we go and thank each one. We say I'm teaching him at a young age to thank the animal for feeding us, and just having that moment of reflection is really important to realize this is a sacrificial thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of emotion with that as well.
For sure. Chelsea, do you have comments?
I think just to add is that we ourselves, and as well as all the other producers that bring their animals here, we know that we cared for them in their life, and we'll care for them in their up until their last moments, and then they care for us by nourishing us. So it's a relationship.
A reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, and it's noted. It's definitely something that we consider.
And it also means that your children have no illusions about how meat got into the store or, you know, into packaging. It's not coming from some place unknown. They know exactly what the cycle is, and they learn from you the respect for the animals. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Lydia McKnight, the co-owner of Yankee Flats Meats, and Chelsea Keenan, the co-owner of Keenan Family Farms and the Black Forest Noodle Company. Another aspect of what you do that I think is part of a respectful approach to the animals that you raise is that you try to use every part of the animal. You don't, I think probably in the large-scale industrial growing operations, they may do that as well, but they do it in a very different fashion. They pile it up in a big heap and ship it off somewhere. But talk a little bit about that, about the way all the different parts of the animal, Lydia, are utilized, that it's part of your sort of mandate, if you like.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that we're doing. Like there's the educational side of things, because a lot of people are used to going to the grocery store and getting bacon and, you know, living off of that, or chicken breast, and there's only so much bacon that comes from a pig, and there's only so many chicken breasts that come from a chicken. But we're wanting to educate on how to use as much of the animal as possible to reduce food waste. And part of the respect of raising and processing those animals is using as much from them, using as much from them as we can. So a few things that we're doing, one product that we just came out with this week is a butcher's blend ground beef. So using liver, heart, tongue in that ground. So we're trying to find unique ways where we can incorporate different parts of the animal and still have it be an accessible product that people know how to use, so they can make their usual shepherd's pie or lasagna, and it's going to have that added nutrients, one from the organs, and then also using more parts of the animal. Something that we do too is we render lard. We use that, and we use it for soap as well. So we make soap with rendered lard, rendered tallow, and for like skin products. But I think a big piece of it's education, because like Chelsea was saying before we went on air, is people are used to getting just pork tenderloins, and there's only two that comes out of a pig. So you know, we have to educate on what comes from an animal and how to use it. So I am trying, I'm kind of on the marketing social media side of things, and we try to put videos together to educate, and having a background in nutrition, that's something that I'm really passionate about.
Yes, education obviously is really important because people don't always have a clue, to be honest, what they're buying. They just look at what's on the shelf in the store. Chelsea, in your stores, you have now a store in Vernon, you have a store on your farm, and you're also selling in lots of other places, which we'll talk about a bit later. But that whole notion of using as much of these animals as you can, how does that, you know, contribute to the way you look at what you're doing?
Well, what comes to mind originally on that comment is with our eggs and the noodles. That's kind of a
B-grade eggs.
Didn't touch on.
I learned about B-grade eggs.
Right.
Really, what is it about B-grade? Is it just cosmetic, basically?
Yes. So it's any imperfections on the shell, or it's mainly imperfections on the shell. Mm. So also too small or too large eggs. Those can't go. There's no market for that. Nobody wants tiny eggs or eggs that don't fit in cartons. So when the opportunity arose for us to purchase an egg noodle company, another match made in heaven. So originally our plan was just to feed excess eggs to the pigs. But turns out the pigs can't necessarily use the eggs as a feed replacement. It's a nice treat, but we needed a way to use all these extra eggs.
It's like chocolate cake for pigs. You can't give it to them all day long. How did you acquire the noodle company? That's a bit of a story there too.
It was for sale at the exact right moment. And so it was, they've been producing noodles in Vernon and Lake Country since 1988, I believe. And we purchased that in December of last year and moved the production to our farm here. And we use about 300 eggs a day to make egg noodles, which are distributed actually across Western Canada.
They're very economical too. I think it was something like $4.50 for a pound or something. That's not exactly the price, but it was roughly that, right?
Yeah, and they are delicious. And so just the fact that they're made locally and made with locally produced eggs from our family farm is really a huge bonus for that product.
You said
that would be my answer to using all of the products we produce. And just I think that attitude is extended to all of our businesses where we're trying to be the most efficient and sustainable. And so that just speaks for the way we operate as a team. We're always looking for opportunities. Mm-hmm. Another thing we did that you didn't mention, Lydia, we have partnered with dog food companies, right, that use the chicken feet and chicken necks and things like that that come out of the abattoir. So that's another aspect of that too.
I wonder, is there any, especially because the way your animals are raised, they are much cleaner, if I can call it that, chemically speaking, than animals raised in factory farming. Bone meal is sold in you know, local plant stores, you know, where they're selling plants for your garden stores. Is there any system that is available to operations like yours where you could take the bones and grind them up and make bone meal out of them? This is just me asking a question out of pure ignorance.
I don't think we would ever. Bone meal usually comes from the saw, from like sawing, and then you can scrape off. You can't really like grind the bones necessarily.
Okay.
But I don't know if there is. Most companies. So we had approached dog food companies before that were larger, and we couldn't produce enough for them to want a contract with us. So that was unfortunate because that was one of our options for limiting waste as well. So it's smaller dog food companies that we work with for different parts like organs and stuff like that too.
So why don't we talk a little bit about each of your origin stories? Because it's, as many guests on this show have related, you didn't start saying, oh, let's run a full operation with pigs and chickens out in the country. Lydia, you probably of the two sides of the operation had a little more sort of background to do with farming, because when you were a kid, you worked. You described the term as horticultural assistant, which sounds pretty pretty magnificent for a young girl. What was the horticultural assistant work in Ottawa, and then later in Nova Scotia?
Yeah, I was really excited to work when I was 12, and we had a family friend who had a farm. That was the title that he gave me. I could have been a farmhand, but he said I was an organic horticultural assistant, actually.
Well, that's even better.
Yeah, so it was really just a farmhand. So I was weeding, picking picking vegetables. It was a organic vegetable farm, and just really in the dirt. I loved it. I loved learning where my food came from, having that connection. I loved cooking. I was always interested in nutrition. My sister had cancer when she was younger and had leukemia. And then the farmer that I was working with had also had cancer. So he was always talking about nutrition and food. And I really had a passion for that, and realized how life-giving farming was and how close to our being and soul it is. So I'd always had an interest in that and knew I wanted a farm of some sort. So when I met Scott, he was very entrepreneurial, my husband, and he was always throwing ideas off of me. And then he mentioned farming and I said, stick with that one and let's go with that.
Was it before or after you married him?
He was always giving me ideas, but after I married him, he was wanted to live.
It wasn't a condition of marriage.
I knew that he'd come around to something.
But you were studying in Nova Scotia. You were studying in a 5-year program, which is quite a long program, yes. Bachelor of Science in Nutrition and Dietetics. So you really plunged in, to the food world, learning about what food does.
Yeah, absolutely. And a really big part of that program too is food security. And having that background in farming, that's really what I was interested in, community and food security, and how do we incorporate agriculture and encourage, like, grow our local food system and make it stronger. So when we moved to BC and we were looking at farming pigs, we wanted to be as self-sufficient as we could be viably. So we created that shipping container to do our own meat processing. Right. And we realized really quickly, it's really hard to do it all, first of all, by yourselves. And that the really big gap was the processing, because farmers were getting out of farming because they had nowhere they could go to take their animals to be processed that was licensed to allow them to bring meat to market. So although our initial passion was farming, our other passions, food security, and having that gap really was an opportunity to strengthen our food system locally.
And 2021 was a real watershed year, because that's when the heat dome took place, which killed people as well as animals. Then there was the atmospheric rivers that took out the highways. And it was a drought season. I mean, it was astonishing how disruptive that was. And it really did expose some of the weaknesses and the fragility in not just food production, but food distribution. And this whole notion of sending animals far away, and your eggs, for example, Chelsea, sending them far away to be graded, that was these kind of long-distance processing niceties make no sense when people can grow the food in one place, then have all these niceties carried out, and then distribute it and have people eat it right in the area. That's so much more secure as a system. Now, Chelsea, while Lydia and Scott were working on things out here, you had moved up here, but from a background that had no direct connection to farming or growing food. Your background was in computer science, as you said, marketing and human resources. Now, what were you actually doing? That could cover a multitude of sins. what were you actually doing?
Out of high school, I did a computer science as a diploma. And then I was working at a software company in human resources. And then I moved to the family business, which is actually a jewelry store. And I was fourth generation. So there's quite a lot of skills that were learned along the way
For sure.
that are applicable to small business, but also farming. It has to be a business to be sustainable too. So I was able to apply those things to the farm. And then my husband, James, was
a carpenter.
A carpenter, that's right. So,
but he worked on he worked on big commercial buildings too. So
yeah,
that's very appropriate. That was a good choice.
Yes, it all fits in the timeline.
Yeah.
But we needed space for our family and just a breath of fresh air to get out of the Lower Mainland, and that was just where it started. We knew we needed more for our kids and our family, and so we started to look for land, and we thought, let's try starting a farm. And so we started reading books and watching videos, and then we gave ourselves a couple of years to make it sustainable and decided we wouldn't be working off farm. We would give it 100% right to the farm. And so we bootstrapped it, and here we are 7.5 years later.
That's like setting off in a boat saying, we're going to keep rowing until we hit land. It's got to be out there somewhere.
That's right.
Remind listeners that once again that I'm speaking with Lydia McKnight, the co-owner of Yankee Flats Meats, and Chelsea Keenan, the co-owner of Keenan Family Farms and the Black Forest Noodle Company. You know, once again, Chelsea, as with your husband, Scott, Lydia, he and you learned farming from scratch. I mean, it's fascinating that this is possible in our times. I have, for example, people coming to my office, a physician who have consulted Dr. Google extensively, and some of my colleagues I know find that a bit challenging, but I actually think it's fascinating because people can come in with names of conditions or surmises about what's happening to themselves. It's a little bit different because they're expecting me to say something sensible when they say that to me. But you were actually starting and putting what you were learning into very concrete action. Can you remember what it was like, Chelsea, when you were sort of, the two of you were reading about farming and thinking, okay, I think I understand that. Okay, we'll do that. And all right, let's make it like this, this big, this small. Do you remember those thoughts as you were going through that process, that really powerful learning process?
I think that we tried everything on a smaller scale. One of the things that we stuck to at the beginning was we didn't build anything or invest a ton of money into anything before we knew that's the direction we were going. So we called it a zap strap and poly and pallets and that kind of thing construction, because we knew that we needed to test it out, and we needed to do a lot of trial and error and see what was going to work for us. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to raise two pigs. It's another thing to raise 200 pigs. And so to plan infrastructure around something that you're not sure is going to be viable or sustainable. We stuck with the zap straps in the beginning. We did dabble in a bunch of other different species and kind of rolled back to the pigs and the laying hens every time to say, this is what we can do. This is what we can do well, and not try and do everything. So we then started investing in infrastructure after probably 4 years, actually. But just going at it, we also had mentors in the community, which was really nice when we moved up to the Shuswap. Was like meeting other farmers, gaining relationships with people that have experience, talking with people. The community was always really welcoming to us. Mm. But the trial and error and kind of narrowing it down to things that we know we could scale up and continue to have a viable farm, because that was important. We didn't have off-farm income.
Lydia, you had parents-in-law who had a farm. What as you were sort of scaling up and branching out, what kind of thoughts did you have about what'll work, what won't work, how can we do this? Beeson Block, you know, was obviously in operation before the two of you started working together.
Yeah, so my in-laws actually didn't have a farm. They just had an acreage, and they had like a handful of laying hens. And
Well,
then
that's part of a farm.
we brought
That's
up
a
the idea. They actually were okay with it because Scott had decided to raise a couple of pigs just for them, and they knew they were going to get bacon and sausage out of it, so they were excited about that. And then Scott said, "Well, what if I put 20 and then it turned into 50 in the backyard and everything?" So that was interesting. Definitely, like, I would agree with Kelsey, trial and error was a really big piece. And I was going to say mentorship from local farmers as well. Generally, like, farming would have been something passed down by generation and family, but not having that previously, Scott would call just farmers in the area, cold call them, and just say, "Hey, can I know you're really busy because you're farming. Can I come on a drive with you if you need to, like, take your animal somewhere? Can I just sit in the car with you and pick your brain? I'll bring you a coffee." And they would say, "Oh, sure." So he'd get picked up with somebody to do a hay run or something, and he would just talk about farming. So he learned a lot from local farmers that were willing to give their time to us, which we were really grateful for because it's really hard. Like, there's not a lot of young people in our generation who want to farm
Yes.
because doesn't make us money
You know,
very
actually,
like,
in a certain sense, you guys are part of a new trend, which is for people who care deeply
yeah,
about the
absolutely.
land and about, in your case, animals and whatever, growing things, and wanting to do it right for the planet, you know, and
Yeah.
for themselves and their values. It's really a powerful trend. One thing I must tell you, I learned about pigs, and that is that the ones that are usually grown in these giant feed operations are not bred to be outdoors. I mean, they're bred to not be outdoors. I should put it the other way around. They're bred to be not outdoors, and they get sunburned if they get outdoors. But you have pigs that are selected for their ability to handle the natural world. Chelsea, how did you did when you were sort of looking into it, how did you decide which strains to get? Did you look at their sunburn quotient tolerance or something like that?
Right. Yeah, well, heritage breed pigs are definitely they are made to be out to mate. They're made to be outside. And yes, I have seen that where you take a conventional pig that is specifically bred to be raised indoors and put them outside. They don't fare as well. But our heritage breed pigs have that instinct to wallow in the water, in the mud, and they're hardy in the winter time. They grow lots of hair. And so I think that's generally what like a homesteader would raise is a heritage breed pig. But we have definitely defined our genetic lines into pigs that have good body form, not too much fat. And so that's a tricky thing too, is getting the right genetic lines in there.
Now you've got things going. You really do have things going. I was looking through on the website where your meat and eggs go, because they go all over the place. You've even wormed your way into the heart of Jimmy Pattison, selling eggs through Save On Foods, just the local Save On Foods, which is enough anyway. I mean, they I'm sure take volume. Why don't you describe some of the maybe each of you've got the eggs that are a central feature, Chelsea. How far do you in the local area distribute? There's the Askew's Foods Farmers Market. Why don't you describe that?
Eggs are almost everywhere in the shoe shop, from grocery at all 5 Askew's locations. We're actually we go there's a few locations in Kelowna, but that's the farthest we go. We are in the Safeway in Vernon, Save On in Salmon Arm. But then there's all the little local. There's the Shoe Shop Pie, there's the Forest and Food, they supply bread to Askew's. There's a couple of great restaurants in Blind Bay,
Inspired
Spinnaker
Breads.
Cafe
There's Marcus
is
of Inspired Bread holding up a big box of your
yeah.
eggs.
Yeah, there's Spinnaker Cafe and Timber Restaurant in Blind Bay, up in Blind Bay, and almost every little place in the shoe shop has bean and eggs on the menu, and that's important to us because these people are small business owners that are also supporting another small business. And not all of them are advertising that, you know, we've got Keenan eggs. They're just making a choice to support local. And that speaks for our community. And that's really, I think, even starting out at the farmer's market with the help of Shoe Shop Food Action Society, Serena Kaner and Melanie Bennett with their advocacy for local food, I think has really launched our business into people believing in local and understanding why it's important, even if they're not using it as a marketing tool, right? Like, people are supporting local products because they know they should, not because they think it's going to be better for their business on the financial side.
We've had some of the marketing and grocery managers for Askew's on the show on a couple of occasions, and there's definitely a trend that they see towards increased production of local foods and a change in attitudes in the public at large, that people are saying we'd rather have quality instead of just going for price. And there was this whole movement for global food production was based around price. It wasn't based on quality. And now that the quality of internationally shipped foods has become seriously questioned, what you're doing is becoming more and more appealing to people all the time. Lydia, when you distribute foods or you sell foods or you wander around with a lot of pork in it in your van, you send it out frozen, and you have sort of a little set of rules that you have for people picking them up. I was looking through them. Why don't you just run through them for people so they understand what happens when you get Yankee Flats meats coming to a home near you, such as your own, for example?
Yeah, so we don't deliver to houses, but we do have places that you can shop. So we have our Vernon storefront, Yankee Flats Meats, Fine Meats and Farm Shop. So it's our brick and mortar shop. It's essentially like a farmer's market. We're getting more local products, all local products in there. We're getting even more like produce where you can come shop and pick it out for yourself. We even have fresh meat there straight from the farm that we just processed. So the fact that you can get local fresh meat 5 days a week is incredible in the city. So that is our Vernon Farm Shop. And then we have our Farmgate Farm Shop. So that is on the Keenan Farm Yankee Flats facility. It's in there and you can come pick up. You can pre-order and pick up on certain days. And then the other place that we sell is a Salmon Arm Farmers Market, which you can pre-order for, or you can just come shop every single Saturday. and that is our main areas where we sell. We do have some restaurants as well, like Chelsea was saying. Some of those same restaurants take Yankee Flats Meats. Ratio Coffee and Pastry in Vernon is a really big supporter of us, and I would say the majority of their meat actually comes from us, and they're opening up a little burger joint in the evening that's using our beef. So we've had a lot of support from other local small businesses too, similarly to Chelsea, that want to support us, and they wanted to support us like way before we even opened. They were begging us to get meat to them. So yeah, we've had a warm welcome from a lot of different businesses.
That's the kind of business to get into. Before you even open the doors, there's people saying, could we come to you and get something from you, please. Yeah. We're getting close to the end of the show, and I wanted to just talk about something that you mentioned, Chelsea. A little anecdote of your son Josh when he was about 5, saying to you, if he could grow those little baby carrots like they have in the store, and of course you knew that they were kind of a processed carrot; they were not genetically made that way. And what you described, it was heartbreaking. What was heartbreaking about that for you? I think I have an idea, but what did you feel?
Well, I just knew right away that was his view of food. It was a rounded carrot in a bag. And now, you know, the kids will pull a carrot right out of the garden and eat it with dirt on it. And they know that it comes with a big green top, and it's sometimes has 3 or 4 different divisions off of it. And it's not a perfect little rounded carrot. And I think that showing our family the entire food system, from raising animals, growing gardens. And it's something that I hope we never take for granted, because we came from a position of my 5-year-old thinking that carrots were round and came in a plastic bag. So I think that has impact on our next generation.
I couldn't agree more. I think what you're doing, showing your kids, as you said earlier, you know, what it's like to work hard, that food security doesn't come out of a package. It comes out of a way of life. Doing so many things for yourselves, preparing the food, monitoring the food, etc., and dealing with the kinds of changes that everybody's dealing with when the climate changes. And you have insulated the population of this area against one kind of food shortage just by the operations you're doing, and people appreciate it. It's really been nice to have you on the show. I mean, I enjoyed our conversation before, and I enjoyed our conversation today. And I do think you're raising a generation of young people, as well as doing the work you're doing, that will one day come to realize how much they have learned that is important for them to be viable citizens and fit in with what's coming down the pike for all of our society. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for being with us today, and good luck to your operations. If they continue the way they're going, they will do very, very well. Thank you.
Thank you.